Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Tonight, our 40-minute speaker is Jerome S. from Corona. Welcome, Jerome.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Jerome, and I'm a very grateful and fortunate member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm grateful for a very explicit reason. See, not only has Alcoholics Anonymous helped me find a way to live life on life's terms and not duck or dodge any of life's issues and not drink, it introduced me to a power that not only solved my drinking problems, but it solved all my problems. And I assure you, I'm not a has-been, I'm a never-was. And that wine took me to a point in life where getting up just didn't cross my mind. I've told people on the corner, I'm not going to stop drinking wine until they stop crushing grapes. My sobriety date is June 6, 1973. I've been sober a little over 37 years, and like I said, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was broke, busted, and couldn't be trusted, suffering from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. See, I'm a typical, well, now I say atypical newcomer that comes to AA. I'm always the last one in and the first one out. See, I came to scoff. But I like to think that a loving God, an act of providence, not out of Jerome's virtue, that I'm here today. Because to me, it was kind of accidental that I got into AA in the first place. I met this girl up in Camarillo State Hospital. Boy meets girl on a nut house campus and falls in love. Baby spoke four foreign languages. She had grew up in the best prep schools in Europe. Her father was a career diplomat for the United Nations. But baby was in the nut house with me. And she would say, Jerry, they're going to have an AA meeting at 8 o'clock. Let's go. They're going to have some donuts, cookies, and coffee, and we might get some cigarettes. And I cuss her out on the side of my mouth. But out of lust and loneliness, I went to an AA meeting. See, I'm a prime example. It's not what you come for. It's really what you stay for. Shoot, I got out of that treatment program. That was the first treatment program I had ever been in. No, well, I take that back. That was the first inpatient treatment program I had been in. My dad and mom saw I was having some very significant emotional and mental issues, and they got me some psychiatric intervention. And I never forget, after the intake and assessment, I sit in the lobby waiting to talk with the psychiatrist, and I met one of my friends. And he flashed on me. He flashed them Red Devils, them Black Mollies. And he said, do you take that and that? That went my enthusiasm for help. But anyway, this lady, I got out of the hospital, and since I had done such a wonderful job in staying sober, I was 90 days sober, separated from alcohol, and I was living on the good graces of my parents, because the deacon didn't play that mess. And the very first day I got out, since I had done such a wonderful job in getting me sober, I decided to get me drunk and do it again. And she called me up. She said, do you want to go to an AA meeting? Just to get them off my case, I said, I'm going to AA. I'm going to get better. She came and picked me up. And we went to this AA meeting in L.A. It was called the Wilshire Normandy Group. It's no longer there. Big, huge speaker meeting on Sunday evening. Maybe about 300 people in the room. And we get up to the meeting, and I'm in an intense, alcohol-intoxicated argument about AA. And I'm telling her, I say, look, baby, we don't need this AA stuff. You sponsor me, and I'll sponsor you, and we can work this stuff out. And we got into an intense argument as my voice raised and got louder and louder and more belligerent and more belligerent. And it was this guy at the meeting, just like Zach. That was his commitment at the meeting. It was this sober member at the meeting. Saw this commotion and came over into our conversation uninvited and says, I'll be your damn sponsor. Now, see, if looks could have killed, he would have been dead. But I looked over my shoulder. There was three other guys at the door. It didn't make no sense in having a confrontation. And he whipped out his card. He says, Jack K is my name and sobriety is my game. Call anytime. And I got to my seat in the meeting. I said, damn, he's a poet. For 10 months, I collected those cards. Because, see, I was on probation for a $5 bag of weed. And I had been on probation for 6 years. They give traffic tickets for that. People got cards today. And this probation officer I had, Mr. Linker, he was a very cruel and insensitive county servant. He had violated me at least 3 times prior to that. And every time he violated me, he had me sent to the Wayside Honor Rancho up in Sargas. And they had a job for me up in Sargas. My job was to work on the hog farm. And I used to wonder, what someone from South Central know anything about hogs? I never know. And see, working on the hog farm is very nasty. Very nasty. You have to clean up the hog feces. And they give you a big old high-pressure hose and some rubber boots up to here. And you have to get in this trough and spray it down. And you slide everywhere. And the stench stay with you for days. I didn't like Mr. Linker. Mr. Linker wanted me to go to AA. So I was going to AA, and Jack would give me that card and give me that card and give me that card. And I get drunk. I last one in. I always found a reason to get drunk. I always had excuses why I couldn't go to the meeting. The Lakers were on. Star Trek. I always had some excuse. You know, I'm one of those famous people. Say, I know and yeah, but. And he would violate me. So what happened was, in June of 1973, I ended up back in Camarillo State Hospital. That's why I'm known in some circles as a Camarillo Nut House Rethread. See, I had been on Skid Row. The deacon, my dad, took pity on me and took me in. Well, my brother was getting married, and he told my dad that he wanted me to be the best man at his wedding. So they paid some tramps to come down there on Skid Row to find me, and they cleaned me up. And they was just wrestling with this alcohol problem, you know. And, well, it was my problem, but they thought they were responsible for it. But anyway, I'm up here in this mental institution for the second time, June 1973, and I had 3 visitors. The first visitor I had was just before Mother's Day. Tall Caucasian gentleman, about 6'5", walk in with a suit and tie, with a bulge over his shoulder. I knew immediately who he was. It's the police. See, you have to know those identification issues when you grow up on the street. So I was well keen with that. I said, well, he's not looking for me. And he went over there and asked for me. And all you ought to see me start sweating. I'm talking about, you get that queasy feeling in your stomach? Oh, I said, something has done happened. What have I done now? Because, see, when you drink and have blackouts, you can do a lot of things. And he came over there and introduced himself. He says, I'm a special agent from the Internal Revenue Service. I relax. See, if you don't have any assets, the IRS won't put you in jail. And what he says, see, I had worked for IBM, my psychiatrist, with my parents. I was having that emotional difficulty in 69. I was having these emotional difficulties, so she took me to the psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist asked me this question. He said, why do you drink and drop those red devils and fall out and knock out your teeth and break your wrists? And I told him, I said, if I had a job and a girlfriend, I would not drop red devils and I would not drink wine and I would not sleep for 72 hours in a coma. He said, come back next week. He had a job for me. He knew some people, and he got me a job at IBM. They was paying me more money than my daddy ever made in my life. I had a ride. The next week, he had a girlfriend for me, my therapist. But she was too old. I said, no, I don't want to mess with no old women. I'll leave her alone. But I took the job, but I only lasted there 10 months. Just 69, my record was so bad, this was my big break. When you don't meet your performance goals at IBM every quarter, you don't get a raise. And I had missed my performance raise 2 quarters in a row, 6 months there. And so I had to go see the Western Region manager of IBM, sat on IBM's board. And I went up to his office, Mr. Trimbicki. And he said, was looking at my personnel folder. And he says, hold it, Mr. Scott. I don't want you to say a word. I want you to hear me out. He says, IBM is an enlightened company. And we believe in salvaging our employees. And I've been a manager of men for over 40 years. And you have the attendance record of someone who is a chronic alcoholic. But listen to me. I want you to know what we do. We will provide some treatment for you at no cost to you. And when you get out of treatment, we'll give you a fresh start in this company. You'll get a new supervisor, a new work location, and nobody in this company will know you have this problem but me. And if you're in any financial difficulty, we'll offer you a loan that you can pay back at 10% of your pay. I looked at that man and told him, how dare you insinuate that I have a problem with alcohol. Got all indignant. And that morning I was trying to get my coffee. And I stormed out of his office. He could have fired me for insubordination. And I got to the elevator. I said, fool, go back and get the loan. And I went in and I said, excuse me, Mr. Patrick, I don't mean to be so abrupt like that, but I am having some financial difficulties. He said, you go down to payroll, they'll cut a check, whatever you need that you can pay back. And as I turned to walk away, he said, Mr. Scott, hold on a minute, sir. He says, if you miss another day in the next 90 days, you can come and pick up your last check. And the Rams was playing Green Bay, and Roman Gabriel was quarterback, and I had a beer. It was snowing in Green Bay that day. I had $100 on that game, and I had a beer. I was so nervous. And I went in a blackout, didn't come to Tuesday. Oh, they didn't want me to have that job, so I was fired. And I had this apartment, real nice apartment. All of my friends in the neighborhood in South Central looked up to me. I'm living on West Side, looking pretty good. Well, it's not the West Side of L.A., but it was Cross Main. But I'm doing well. Got me a nice job, nice little old ride. And I went to this here after I got fired, got my severance paid off their loan, had a couple thousand in my pocket. I said, I'm going to go hear some jazz. Go to the jazz club, meet a lady, invite her and her friends over. They come over and they steal everything I got. And add insult to injury, they tied me upside down in the closet. Landlord come looking for his rent. That's a very sad occasion, you know. I'm going to come back. That's what I was telling myself that morning. I'm going to come back. And I walked out of that place. I think it was early 1970. I walked out of that place. And I guess for the next 3 years, I was on Skid Row selling whole blood every 58 days and plasma twice a week. And I got real sick. with a coat too long to be short and too short to be long. And my brother, and they came down there and got me off of Skid Row. And I made all those promises that I'd made before. I'm going to straighten up, fly right, turn over a new leaf, take care of business. I'm going to get me a job. I'm going to check back into school. I'm going to make you proud. But every time I start on one of these adventures, I have to have me one. And my resolve would be gone. So I ended up back in Camarillo. And that guy, he wanted his $14,000. Because I had told him on my income tax that I had 8 kids. Well, the form say if you have 8 kids, you can get all your money back. I didn't know they was going to check. So in 1969, by 1963, it had penalties and interest. $14,000. I don't know how. He must have asked my dad where I was. He said in Camarillo. Came up there to get his money. I said, you can't get blood from a turnip. He said, well, when you get on your feet, Mr. Scott, you come and see us. I stuck those foam rubber slippers out. I said, do it look like I'm going to get on my feet anytime soon? Oh, they got their money. They never forget. In Mother's Day, Mr. Linker, my probation officer, not parole officer, my county probation officer came up to Camarillo from L.A. County with his 90-year-old mother just to see me. And when he came on the ward, he talked. I was really nervous. I was looking for the police with him for violation. He said, I just come to encourage you to do the right thing and get your recovery going. He talked real nice to me. It surprised and shocked me that some county employee would be that caring and supportive. I was unnerved by it. Then he asked me, how do you get to Port Hueneme? And I knew the shortest way is out the south gate of Camarillo. He didn't know where that was, but I did. I said, I'll show you. And I walked down there to show him the way, and his little 90-year-old mother in the car, and then he got real nasty in front of his mother. He flipped on me. He said, you think you're fooling me coming to this program, don't you? You're not fooling me. If I hear you in the vicinity of a liquor store, if you get arrested for jaywalking or spitting on the sidewalk, you're going to do 366 days in the county jail. And you will not get one day of good time for it. You're going to do every one of those days. And his little 90-year-old mother stuck her head out the window and said, good luck, young man. I wanted to cuss her out. I'm going to jail. That's what I do. If I get drunk, God forbid, I'm going to jail. Because I do stupid stuff. Stupid. Like, I'm sitting over there playing dominoes with Rabbit, Mad Dog, and Pookie. I see the police drive up, and they stop this guy, and they question him across the street, a boulevard. I get off the front porch, walk across the street, and go inquire, why are they harassing this man? He seems to be doing nothing wrong. And guess who went to jail? I did. And he said, thank you, brother. I appreciate it. Stupid stuff. And I know I'm going to jail because that's what I do. And you know I'm real depressed in that mental institution. I'm depressed. See, I can't visualize a life with alcohol, and I can't visualize a life without it. Nothing has worked. And just before Memorial Day weekend, I'm sitting in that nut house, well, that mental institution, that treatment program, waiting on my vitamin yeast pills. And it was another newcomer who my sponsor sponsored. His name was Raymond. Raymond had Jack's card, too. Jack K is my name and sobriety is my game. Call anytime. And Raymond called him Collect. And say, Jack, I'm in a mental institution. Will you come and get me? On the strength of a collect call, he made a 12-step call on Raymond. He drove from that plush home in West Hollywood In that AA Beamer that AA had gave him, that had OID on the license plate, and came up and picked up Raymond, and they was leaving. I'm sitting there that Sunday morning reading the Los Angeles Times business section if I had some stocks or bonds. Yeah, well, I was just checking what IBM was paying that day. I want to see if that one share I had, if it had split. And Jack E's behind the paper. I didn't see him. But I knew that voice from AA. He's the kind of guy that's always up in your face. How you doing, Jerome? I want to hug. Man, don't hug me. Every time I saw him at the meeting, he never forgot my name. He's rushing over there to me. How you doing, Jerome? And I had that newcomer line. I'm fine. Lying. He going out of his way to try to help me. And my arrogance and my self-centeredness push him away. Because you know what I'm saying? I ain't nothing. I ain't going to be nothing. So why even waste that man's time? Because I had squandered my one and only chance in life. It was gone. And I wasn't coming back. And he asked me a question. He says, Jerome, what are you doing here? And for the first time in my miserable young life, I got honest. My guard was down. My defenses. I wasn't defensive. And I gave him an honest answer. And sad and tragic as it was, I looked at him and I said, Jack, I don't know. I had no idea I suffered from an illness of body, mind, and spirit. See, I was just playing crazy. And I found out later in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a distinct line between playing crazy and being crazy. Sometimes you think you're playing, you done skipped across the line. It's best not play, Jay. And he saw my confusion and my lack of understanding. And that day in the latter part of May, he didn't stand over me from some spiritual mountaintop being superior AA member and judge me. I looked in that man's eyes that day and I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that that man loved me. That man was willing to do anything on this planet to help me. Because he said something. He says, Jerome, if you do what I do and follow what I follow, you will never have to drink again. And you will never have to come to a place like this unless you choose to. That's the promise that Alcoholics Anonymous gives us. If we work this program in its entirety and in its continuity, the promise rarely ever fails. And rarely means almost never. But see, I have something that will keep me sick. And it's very entrenched in my psyche. As a matter of fact, my whole fiber in existence is shot through with it. It's that fear and that baseless pride. It'll come up and justify almost anything. That fear says, you better not go that way, Jerome. You ain't nothing and you ain't gonna be nothing. And that pride say, you don't need to let him help you. You can do it yourself. And I done failed again and again and again. I'm talking about hosts of people. Going out of his way to help me. That psychiatrist that got me the job. I call him up in the middle of the night, suicidal, wake him up in the middle of the night. Why are you taking all these pills? He sit and talk to me all night long. I wouldn't do anything he tell me to do. Matter of fact, lied on him because the police caught me with those second-off barbiturates. And I told them they were prescription. They were prescription, but I didn't get them from the prescription place. And I'm getting ready to go to prison for 5 years. And I lied real quick. I said, oh, my doctor prescribed this medication for me. They said, well, who your doctor is? I'm Dr. Frank Williams. And they called him up. I'm in the felony tank down at Parker Center. They're getting ready to roll me out. And they come down and say, roll them up, Jerome, you can go. And you know, I thought I was the slickest person on this planet for 30 years. I didn't even realize that they called him and he lied. And I told Jack that story. You know how you do inventories with your sponsor. They don't forget. And he said, Jerome, he got mad at me. He got real angry. He says, Jerome, in 29 years, you never told me that story. He says, here's what I want you to do. That doctor lied for you. I want you to find that doctor and place yourself at his disposal and do anything he asks you to do. Well, you know, even at 29, I said, well, I ain't going to rush and find him. You know, I'll do a perusal look, but I'm not going to go, like, look him up on Facebook or nothing. Because he might ask me to do something. And I'm talking with a guy I went to college with, because we was in a BA program at Cal State Dominguez. And he had got his master's in social work, and he was working for this doctor. And he was telling me, this doctor paid top dollar, Jerome. You ought to come and work here. I said, I ain't coming to L.A. He said, man, your money is good. I said, well, who is it? He said, Dr. Frank Williams. I said, damn. So I called him up to make amends. That's one thing about me and Jack. If he told me to do something, I did it. Because I made a decision that day, that first 24 hours of sobriety, I ended up, after Jack left from that mental institution, I ended up getting $67. The deacon had sent me $67 to catch the bus home from Camarillo. He was still going to take me in. And I got to the deacon's house in a drunken stupor and a blackout. And in that drunken stupor and that blackout, I went off into a violent rage. I beat the only friend I had on this planet. The only person that would put his house up so I could get out of jail. The only person would take that long bus ride down to the county jail, Wayside, Honor Rancho, Camarillo, stay in long lines so his crazy son could have enough money for a pack of cigarettes. I beat him down. The only person that really never gave up on me. That's how I repaid him. The police came. Newton Street. They came. I'm out there foaming at the mouth. Them bust out every window in the front of their house. And I'm out there trying to commit suicide by a cop. Oh, I'm so grateful that it was daytime. I don't know what to do. Because if it was night, you guys would have a new speaker. They took me and arrested, put me in the jail for plain drunk. They didn't get me for assault, doing all that stuff. Gave me a kick out the next day. And I still had some of that $67, and I got drunk again. And I came back over there, and I saw my father's sister who lived across the street. And that wine say, get her too. And I chased her in her house. I burst right through the screen door. But see, Auntie liked to drink and take pills, too. See, Auntie wasn't not running from me out of fear. She was running to the bedroom between the box spring and the mattress where she had her pearl-handled snub-nosed 38. And she had that bad boy cocked. Because, see, your relatives are different from people on the street. They say, oh, don't kill him, he's drunk. Your relatives will take you out. They will. I know them Scots. She was getting ready to let off a few rounds because she was sitting up there saying, come on in, nephew. Come on. Just a little further. I saw that pistol. And a gun has something to do with when you're drunk. It just takes your high all the way. It was gone. I don't know where it went, but you ought to have saw me get out of there. I backed over the banister, around the house, jumped over the fence, and was behind the apartment building in the trash dumpster, peeking out. Got out, and the police took me to jail again. Now I know I'm going to jail for 366 days. Ain't no doubt. And I'm laying on that jailhouse floor on the 5th of June in a drunken stupor, and I have a spiritual awakening. It dawned on me, all the people that had been trying to help me. There was hordes and hordes of people, not only my family, everybody was jumping monkey flips trying to help me. And I was playing this vicious, sick game. You fix it, and then if it don't work to my specification, let me blame you. And that day, on the 5th of June of 1973, I made a commitment. I didn't make a promise. I made a commitment. See, I made a commitment, and I think I took the first step that day. I took the first step in recovery. See, a lot of people think the first step in recovery is we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. The first step in recovery is in chapter 3. We learn to concede to our innermost selves that we are alcoholic and that we are bodily, mentally different. That means there are more than one Jerome, because they put it in the plural. We learn to concede to our innermost selves. So I equate that with me, myself, and I. Sometimes me and I want to get me drunk. So they all have to be in agreement. And that day I made a commitment. I knew Alcoholics Anonymous worked in Jack's life. I knew it. I could see it. I could really see it working in his life. All that stuff he was doing at the meeting, I was watching. All the people he's helping, I'm watching. But I'm telling myself, you ain't nothing and you ain't going to be nothing. So why even waste this man's time? I made a commitment that day. I said to myself, because I could hear him say, Jerome, if you follow what I follow and do what I do, I made a commitment. I say, if Jack, I'm going to do whatever Jack Kissel tells me to do. If he asks me to jump, I'm going to ask him how high. And I'm a belligerent unbeliever. Me and God is not on speaking terms. I came to scoff. I'm so thankful I remained to pray, because so much has happened in 37 years. My sponsor died a little over a year and a half ago. But I got me a new sponsor, because I don't do well sponsoring myself. What has happened to me is beyond explanation. I have to think it's nothing but a wholesale miracle. Because like I said, when I came to out of that madness, I didn't have any viable skills. And those people in my home group, they don't like what they call them, AA bums. That's what they call them at my home group. Oh, they were so cruel to me. Oh, they were so unmerciful. It was this one lady. See, at my home group, when I got sober in 73, you couldn't have a burning desire to share. They would just say straight up, what can you tell us about recovery and staying sober? You can tell us how to get drunk. We all know how to get drunk here. So sit down, shut up. That would hurt my feelings. I'm sensitive. But I could not wait to get to my 90 days at the beginners group on Friday night to share my experience, strength, and hope. I had been practicing. And I got up there, my 90 days, and I says, newcomers, one day my ship is going to come in and everything is going to be all right. Keep coming back. The program works. And I went and asked my buddy, how did I sound at the podium? And they called on this lady. She had 20 years. And they said, Jerome, this is not a crosstalk meeting, but it's my duty and responsibility to share recovery. She said, you've been talking about that crap when your ship is going to come in. She said, when in the hell are you going to send a ship out? And they laughed like for a week. That's what my head was saying. Oh, yeah, she undressed me, but she dressed me back spiritually. She said, Jerome, sometimes life being the way life is, will send a storm so devastating that if your boat is tied to the moorings in the harbor, it'll be smashed against the rocks. And can't nothing come back from that. Sometimes you have to put your ship in God's hands because faith without works is dead. She didn't realize she gave me the key to living. Sometimes you have to put your ship in God's hands because faith without works is dead. See, because faith and fear can't live in the same house. I have to choose. And that's when I got introduced to the 12 steps because, you know, well, you know, I'm one of those slackers too, you know. I'm a half stepper from way back. I only do enough just to get by. And I'm so glad Jack pointed that out to me. He pointed all those things out to me. And he helped me with getting the foundation on the first three steps. Because without a solid foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous, the structure you're going to build is not going to withstand. It will not allow you to have the spiritual growth and development to face the low spots that are due to come. So you have to be, Jack would say that you have to be thorough with this, Jerome. And he says, this is what I want you to do, since you're so brainiac. He says, I'm going to give you, he says, here's how we're going to do the steps. He says, we're going to do the first, second, and third step, and we're going to do it this way. He says, I want you to get your big book, because at first it was a wine coaster. I never read it. I just wanted to show people I had one, that, you know, I have plenty in my library. He says, no, I want you to read the doctor's opinion. He says, then I want you to skip Bill's story. Got a powerful story, but we're going to skip Bill's story for right now. I want you to read There's a Solution. Then I want you to read More About Alcoholism. And he says, then I want you to read the lost chapter in the big book, the one that everybody just skips over. I want you to pay special attention to that, We Agnostics, because it's going to be critical. And then he said, I want you to read chapter 5, but I want you to stop at page 63 where it says, We Were Reborn. I don't want you to go any further than that, Jerome, because we're going to treat this like a textbook. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous book is. It's the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, now I want you to go back and read the same stuff again, the same chapter, the same order, but with a different purpose on this second reading. Every time you come across a question mark noted in the text, I want you to stop and rephrase that question as if it applied to you personally. And he told me this. He said, Bill wanted to make a textbook. He didn't want to write it like a typical textbook, put the questions at the end of the chapter, because the alcoholics wouldn't pay any attention to it because they have a short attention span. He sprinkled the questions all through the text. And he says, when he really wanted to get your attention, he italicized the writing. I want you to pay close attention to that, too. And when you get to page 63, you should have 63 questions. And then we're ready for a discussion. Then we're ready to do the third step. And it gives you a specific way of doing it. But once you do the third step, Jerome, we got to get into action. Because you got a lot to uncover and discover and discard. Because you'll get a Big Bang Theory and you start feeling good. Yeah, I'm so glad that's over with. Oh, now I'll go to the 12th step. But you got to do some other work. Strong foundation for the third step. And that's why it's really important for me on page 53 in We the Agnostic. It was a pivotal point in my recovery when I read that phrase. It says, when we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we could neither postpone nor evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that neither God is or neither God is not. And I always like to say neither God can or he can't. What is my choice to be? I choose to think God can do it. And I went to go about that. I give you an example. Couldn't find work. Oh, people look at my application, only one job, and you're 26 years old? They would ask me, where you been? You know where they thought I was. I was in prison. No, I ain't been in prison. I've been on the streets. And they said, well, we hope you get it together. And I was despondent. I almost drank. This guy, I went down and interviewed for the job 3 times. And then I had to meet the head manager at the movie studio just to be a janitor. And my janitor job was going to pay some money. Because, see, I had did my work inventory with my sponsor, Jack. And he asked me, what did my father teach me how to do? My father was a janitor. He taught me how to clean stuff. And he said, Jerome, you'll never be without a job. You can always some stuff to clean. So I thought I was going to get this job at the studio, and it paid. Whoa, it did it pay good. I said, dang. But that guy told me, he said, I don't want any alcoholics on my studio. And if you ain't off my studio in 3 minutes, I'm going to call security and get you off. I done went down there and interviewed with everybody there except the head man. He kicked me off his lot, and I was at the corner crying crocodile tears. Went to my men's stag meeting. They said that job wasn't for you. I said, what do you mean it wasn't for me? If God wanted you to have that job, Jerome, nothing in this planet could stand in the way. And I left that meeting with this guy named Emmett. Emmett said, Jerome, we're going to treat this spiritually. See, I'm not the praying type. Emmett pulled over on the street corner, and he said, give me your hands. I got a little concerned. But I did it anyway. He was an AA member. I gave my hand, and he started praying. And the next day, I'm at that AA clubhouse with a bunch of other losers thinking about going and getting drunk. This guy walks in. He just walks in and off the street. Anybody in here want a job? I said, damn, God, not so quick. I took that job too. Yeah. And then I ran into Dr. Williams again. Because at that job at the gas station, I would get robbed every Saturday. And it was very stressful. It's very stressful. They just rob you every Saturday on the weekend. You don't get robbed. You know, that didn't suit with me with sobriety. I didn't get sober to get robbed and shot. So I said, well, since this is my last day on earth, I'm going to go to Thrifty Drugstore and get some Polish sausage and eggs and pancakes for $1.99. And I walked in there, and there's Dr. Williams sitting there at the booth eating. You don't walk up to your psychiatrist on a Saturday morning, how you doing socially? I just, nodded and went back and sit down. And he got up and came over and says, could I join you? I said, sure, Dr. Williams, have a seat. Then he did a mental status exam. Oh, yeah. Oh, he was checking my memory, see if I was oriented into 4 places, You know how psychiatrists talk. They want to check you out first. And then he said, Jerome, there's something different about you. And I can't put my finger on it. I said, Dr. Williams, I'll tell you what that is. He said, well, what is it? I said, it's been 3 years since I had a drink or took a pill. And he says, I'm starting an alcoholism program. Would you like to work there? I said, how much does it pay? He said it paid $12 an hour. That was $4 more than the gas station made. And plus, I didn't think the alcoholics would rob me. But I told him, I said, I can't take this job until I speak with my sponsor. He said, call me up. And I called Jack. As soon as I got to the gas station, I said, Jack, dude, I ran into my psychiatrist, and he wanted to give me a job as an alcohol counselor. He says, Jerome, we don't thread on our AA experience and make money off of it. You could take that job if you make a commitment to go back to school. Once again, we're not going to rush and go back to school, right? But we'll take the job. In the meantime, I didn't like that because it was too stressful there, so I decided I'd work for the post office. I took the test 39 times. And after taking that test 9 times, I memorized all 9 tests, and they have 562 items on the test. And I got perfect scores. And I'll never forget, I went to this post office to get a job. in the San Gabriel Valley. I ain't going to say the city because they were very cruel and mean to me. And he said, you know, on a postal application, the federal government want to know all about you. They want to know dates, places, and dispositions. And they want to know if you've ever been treated for alcoholism or drug addiction. They want that information on there because if they find out and you don't, they'll walk you out of there so fast. And Jack told me, he said, we don't lie in AA, Jerome. We don't shrink from our past. I said, well, Jack, I don't remember. He said, go down to Parker Center, pay the $17, and they'll send for your information at the J. Edgar Hoover Building in the Department of Justice. They know about you, too. Go on down there. So my little application was kind of thick. And this postmaster, I'm going to San Gabriel Valley, he calls my name. I steps up there all whine old sharp like I am tonight. No, I'm going to get a job. He said, I didn't even believe you would show up. He said, but I'm going to give you your interview. He gave me the tour of the post office. Then he showed me this is where the mail comes in. And this is where you go out. And he said, and if you get a work job in my post office, be over my dead body. And bam, slam the door. See, I almost went postal before I worked for him. But see, I got this deal with Jack. Anything that affects my sobriety, my spirituality, my growth and development, I'm current with him. He has to know about it 5 seconds before God. Because Jack don't like to land with my problems. He want to take off with them. So I called up Jack, and I'm just foaming at the mouth how this man that treated me in audacity, I dare him do that, and I'm a human being. And he said, well, Jerome, how many times did you take that test? 39 times, and I ain't going down there no more. He said, well, Jerome, look at it this way, in his calm voice. He said, look at it this way. You might have to go back down there 34 more times as an exercise in character building. Because in Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't shrink at anything. And I asked him to myself, hey, Jack, how much damn character do you want me to have? I went down there 5 more times, and this guy hired me to carry the mail. I worked for him for 21 years, and then they downsized my job. They told me I had to go back to school. Went back to school and got a master's. I had went back to school in sobriety at least 7 times. And 7 times, I failed. And that 9th time I went down there, I took my God with me. And I never forget the first class in college I had was algebra. I never opened a book, and I failed. And I said, to hell with it, because my job was dependent on I stay in school. I had just gotten married. Oh, man, I said, the heck with it. They could do what they want. And the math teacher from Iran, the algebra teacher, came out of the class, left his 45 other students, came out and left them, came down the hall and said, wait, Mr. Scott, wait. He said, if you come 30 minutes early, I'll come 30 minutes early, and I'll help you pass this class. I said, damn, I got a math sponsor now. You know, people don't believe this, but how can you come from doing the Thorazine Shuffle and the Millerill Twist, not one or two times, but many, many times, to being a licensed therapist? That's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the only reason I got any mental and emotional health, is because I've been able to do what they say here. Even though you suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, you can recover. If you have the capacity to be honest. Because I used to ask my psychiatrist, Dr. Williams and all them doctors, they'd be in the case conference talking about me. I know they was talking about me. And I'd be bamming on the door. Bam, bam, bam. And they'd come to the door. I say, I want to know my diagnosis and my prognosis. And he said, Jerome, you can't handle it. It's too deep. And I was 10 years sober. And I was getting a certificate at that time. And Dr. Harris, who was Dr. Williams' partner, came down. He was the head medical director. And he said, they said you was here. I wanted to come down and see. Because I wasn't a very good patient of theirs. I get drunk and get the people don't need to get drunk. I have to drink with somebody, you know. He said, you used to ask what your diagnosis was. And he said, I think I could tell you. He said, we diagnose you as suffering from episodes of schizophrenia and deep-seated neurosis. And we expected you not to ever function in society. You'd be on some psychotropic medication and some boarding care home institution for the rest of your life. And now today I walk as a free human being, wrapped in my own personal brand of dignity, not making any excuses for my existence. This program has given me something that I'll be forever grateful for and I can never pay back. But I love the fact that I found a God in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like to tell you when I found that God. I was in Camarillo, and it was this Jesuit priest. And he was sitting in this here gazebo, and he was sitting there reading and meditating. And I stormed in there, foaming at the mouth, cussing and ratting and raving, wanting to debate about God. And he was so calm, so kind, and so considerate. And he sat and talked with me for about 15 to 20 minutes. And he gave me this track. It's not in the Bible, but I'd never seen it in the Bible, but it was, oh, how constant is your precious love. I seek protection under the comforts of your wings. And I latched on to that because I needed some protection. And I needed some peace because I was in such dire straits. I needed something to allow me to get a grip on some reality. And over the years, I kept adding little things to it. And that's how I got my lovely wife. Because I was the secretary of the Saturday morning meeting. And in the secretary's book, I wrote it in there. And she said, God, that guy is brilliant. If he ever... I said, I didn't know that, but I had my eye on her. I was like, yeah. And I'll share this and sit down and shut up. I want to thank Paul. I want to encourage our new friends. Please keep coming back. Don't go. Don't give up 5 seconds before the miracle happens. Because an alcoholic will go 23 hours, 59 minutes, and 55 seconds. In that last 5 seconds, he'll say, two tears in a bucket and bucket. Don't give up that 5 seconds. Get you some phone numbers. Call some people. Talk with somebody. And it's, oh, how constant is your precious love. I seek protection under the comforts of your wings. For you have made this day. Let me rejoice and be glad in it. For today is the first day of my life. For the rest of my life. One day at a time. And thank you, dear God, just for this day. And may you lead and may you guide me in this prosperous new life. And may I never forget, during the sunshine of my life and during the storms of my life, there is peace with you, dear God, always and forever. And all praise to the loving, living God to whom all praise is due. I want to thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, for my sobriety, but most of all, I want to thank you for another day of sanity.